There you go. Yeah.
All right. Good afternoon. We're going to open up the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government. Today is February 26, 2015. And for now, we're going to open up an informational hearing on House Bill 5020, the Oregon Government Ethics Commission. Once we get a few more folks here, then we'll open up the public hearing on that. So I'm going to open up that informational hearing. Mr. Burson, come on forward. We're glad you're here.
I'm glad I'm here too.
Welcome. So how do we want to run today? How many days do we have the commission before us?
Mr. Co-Chair and members of the subcommittee, you have the Government Ethics Commission for just today for both their agency presentation, the CFO's presentation, and then public testimony. So
right.
They'll be in and out today.
Okay, so colleagues, I'm going to run a tight ship today, if that's all right.
And so, I'm ready.
All right. So why don't we turn this over to you folks, and why don't you get started?
I appreciate your time, Chair Smith and members of the committee. I'd like to introduce Kenny Montoya. He is the chair of the commission, and we're going to go ahead and start off our presentation with a few words from the chair. Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you very much. I am honored to serve this year as the chair of the Oregon Government Ethics Commission. We are a 7-member citizen commission. We come from all walks of life. We do appear to be a heavily lawyer loaded at this time. Pardon that. But we do have some folks with sound common sense rather than us lawyers who look at the pure black and white. I'm very proud of the work that we do with the commission. We get a packet about every 5 weeks. We meet every 6. And the packets can range in size of anywhere from 200 to 400 pages. And we go through considering all kinds of potential ethical violations, from the extremely serious to the relatively head-scratching ones that are brought from communities far and wide. And we do an outstanding job. I'm very proud of the job that we do in considering carefully the matters that are brought before us, and that I assure you folks get a fair shake in front of us. That I said, we got a lot of lawyers. We got a lot of lawyers with heart. We look at the matter and we consider the factors that brought us to this point, as opposed to strictly the red letter law. And the folks that appear before us, some of them have no idea they were even subject to our jurisdiction, and yet they find themselves being brought before us, and they find themselves in the newspapers and are trying to figure out just how to do the right thing. We have a heavy focus on education. That is a thing that we push to our executive director to get our trainers out there to show the people how to avoid being in front of us, as opposed to sanction-oriented. We go through the meetings, and frequently we used to have a member who, or a commissioner who, would add up how much money we didn't find by the time it was all said and done, because that isn't sanctioning isn't our goal. Our goal is education and compliance. We're very proud of that work, and unfortunately, I can talk all day. I'm a trial lawyer, so I'm going to let Mr. Burson speak a little bit.
Welcome.
Thank you again, members of the committee. My name is Ron Burson. I am the executive director for the Oregon Government Ethics Commission, and I have a presentation here for you. So we're going to go start through these slide presentation, if I can do this correctly. So we'll start off here with the mission of the commission, and I'm not here to read the mission to you, but I thought it was particularly important to put the mission up here, because this last year the commission got together and decided that our mission was probably just a little ancient, hadn't really caught up to date, and so we actually spent quite a bit of time discussing amongst the commissioners. And the big thing that we really want to do was, like Chair Montoya had talked about, was this emphasize education in achieving that mission, and that just wasn't reflected in the mission. So, the commission is running off this mission now, and I think it reflects much more accurately of what our purpose is. Just a brief look at the organization. You can tell we're a very large state agency. We barely fit on the page anymore. But in all kidding aside, I'm always proud of the work that we do with the small amount of people that we have. But this is a breakdown of the agency, the positions that are there, and the work that they're there to do. On our revenue side, I know it's a really boring graph that's there, but years ago in 2007, when the Senate Bill 10 went through, there was a change in our assessment or in our funding model that created an assessment model. And in that assessment model, so instead of being general fund, and actually it started in 2009, we started becoming an assessment-based agency. And in that agreement out of the 2007 legislature was that half of the agency's budget would be paid for by state agencies, the other half by local governments. So you get kind of an idea here on state agencies. In the next biennium, they'll be charged $12.78 per FTE. Local governments will pay on their municipal audit fee. And it's hard for me to tell you exactly what they pay. The municipal audit fee has actually 8 different rates on it. But what I gave you here is a range from the smallest jurisdictions out there. I'm sorry.
I'm going to interrupt you really quick here.
No problem.
I'm going to close, colleagues, the informational hearing, and I'm going to open up our public hearing on House Bill 5020. Please continue.
Great. Well, okay. So what I did was I gave you the bottom and the top of the range for all local governments. In the next biennium, we're looking at a biennial charge of $50.63.
Let me ask a quick question on that. How is that fee assessed? Is a bill physically mailed out to the local government?
Chair Smith, it is.
Okay.
That was the agreement back in 2007 that they preferred to get billed as opposed to essentially taking state funds that are sent out to those jurisdictions.
Got it. Okay.
Beforehand. So, again, the municipal audit rate, what I can tell you is the bottom range is for jurisdictions that spend less than $50,000 in a year. The top rate is for jurisdictions that spend over $50 million in a year. So you can see there's a wide difference in these groups. So the small jurisdictions will pay just a little over $50. The large jurisdictions will pay just over $1,000 in the biennium to fund the agency. Areas inside of the commission, first and foremost, again, as Chair Montoya talked about, is education and training. The commission took a very severe paradigm shift clear back in 2007 to try to go from educating people through sanctioning to actually getting out and educating people. So before 2007, the executive director was the trainer. And once I was hired in 2006, they knew right away that wasn't my specialty. So we got some people out there that could actually train some folks. And so we have spent a lot of time on education. It's a high priority for us. We continue to kind of train on the changes of the laws. But what we really try to we're really chasing all the time in education is that the actual public officials change inside of the organizations all the time. So just when you get a group trained, they have new people in the group. So this is going to be an ongoing effort. It's a place, like I say, we put a lot of resource towards. We have two program analysts, ones that are dedicated to this program. We conduct in-person trainings. In fact, I have one coming up in North Powder, which is outside of LeGrand out there. So what we asked them to do is, can you invite all the other small jurisdictions to come in too? So I think Union's coming in and Imbler, and there's several of those small jurisdictions. They're going to bring their school districts, their fire people, their city councils in. Perfect. So once I make the trip over there to do that, we get as many people as we can in the area while we're there. The program includes web-based training. We have iLearn seminars that are out there, but really what we're melding over to is live web-based training. So there's actually my trainer is on the web, and people can write in questions to them as they're watching this, and so we can respond to those folks' questions, and they can take that training while they're sitting at their desk. That, of course, saves the agency money, and it saves the jurisdiction's money from having to send their folks. We have seen an increase in complaints of improper executive sessions over the last few years, and I'll get into that a little bit more later on, but this web-based training seems to be helping with that, trying to get these small jurisdictions, because when I go back to the revenue side, what I failed to mention was there's 1,700 jurisdictions that include in that local jurisdiction, so that are paying our assessment. So there's a lot of jurisdictions out there, and this web-based training seems to be getting out to those boards and commissions so that we try to get them to conduct their executive sessions within the statutes, as opposed to having them come before the commission with complaints and violations. The next area of the commission is investigations. The agency has two positions that conduct all investigations in the agency. You have to understand that the law allows anybody or any entity to file a complaint against any public official of the state. So there's very little control from our commission on how many complaints come in each year. But history-wise, it stands between about 100 and 120 complaints that come in during the year. The investigation process is twofold. There's a preliminary review phase, which is a confidential phase that can last up to 135 days, and then that goes into the commission at that time will make a decision on whether to either move that into a full investigation or dismiss it. If it goes into a full investigation, that can be up to 180 days. At the end of the investigation, an investigation report is produced by the staff, and then the commission at that time will actually vote to recommend either dismissal or a violation at that time. Again, in 2014, we received 112 complaints, and anyway, the average is right at about 110.
Can we go back really quick?
Sure.
So when a complaint is issued, is notification provided to the elected official that a complaint has been issued towards them?
Chair Smith, that's correct. But just to be clear, this is on any public official, so it can be essentially anybody serving government. So
sure.
It's not just elected officials, but
okay.
Whoever is the subject of that complaint is we as an office are required to attempt to call them and mail them a letter within 2 days of receiving that complaint.
I see. Okay. Thank you.
Yes.
Senator Whitson.
Thank you. Mr. Burson, could you just, I understand that the ethics is in Oregon is a complaint-driven process. Could you just walk us through what, you know, how you go about this from, you know, from the time you get a complaint? Do you prioritize those complaints by the severity, like civic versus a potential criminal, or civil versus criminal, the seriousness, like from the standpoint of a few dollars to, say, hundreds of thousands of dollars, whether it's a minor local offense versus a statewide official? Could you kind of walk us through how you select the cases you're going to look at?
Sure. Chair Smith, Chair Senator Hayward, Senator Whitsett, yes. First of all, there's a couple of ways that the commission can open up this investigative process. First of all, through a signed complaint, like you mentioned. The second is through an own motion of the commission itself. So if we receive credible information at the commission, and the commission can actually vote to open up a complaint. As far as prioritization, the law really doesn't allow for us to prioritize the complaints that come in. The time frame is the same whether it's a local water board or whether it's a statewide issue that goes on. So those are assigned to our investigators, and now I do have one investigator that may have a little bit more experience than the other, and so there are times that I do assign what I would consider maybe more difficult investigations to that investigator as opposed to the other. But with the time frames going on, they're very short, and we need to get those done right away. And just to be clear, some of the most contentious violations that we have been local issues because they're very important to the people that are there.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to respond to those people basically the same as we do the others. But anyway, I get that complaint in. I review that complaint. I have to have a reasonable belief that there's been a violation with the information that's in front of me. If I have that reasonable belief as the executive director, I will open that complaint. Once opened, it's out of my hands as executive director, and now it goes into the commission's hands, and it takes a vote of the commission to either move it forward or dismiss it at that time. So it's very important when that initial complaint comes in that that information is reviewed and that, you know, I at that time am going to expend agency resources towards coming up with at least a preliminary review report for the commission to look at the end of that 135 days.
Mm-hmm. So if I, thank you, if I follow the, Mr. Person, if I follow the timeline, then once you have decided as executive director to open the complaint, then the investigators have 135 days to bring that complaint to the commission. And the commission has another sequential 180 days before they have to rule on that. Is that correct?
Chair Smith, Chair Senator Hayward, I'm sorry, Senator Whitsitt, that's not exactly correct. At the end of the 135 days, the commission has to make a decision before that 135 days is up whether to move the case into a full investigation mm-hmm. or dismiss. If they make the decision to go to a full investigation, then us as an agency, my staff now, has 180 days to do a full investigation. And during the investigative phase, we have a few more powers in there. An example of that is we actually have subpoena power to obtain records that we don't have during the preliminary review. The preliminary review is essentially a cursory overview of the materials that have been received by the agency on that particular complaint.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, at the end of the 135 days, and it's always before that, by the way, because we have to hit the meeting before the 135 days is up, because that's a statutory deadline. If we go past that, the complaint is statutory dies. We can't go forward. But before that 135 days is up, the commission itself will make a decision on what to do with that complaint. And when Chair Montoya talked about the books they get before each meeting, inside those books are the reports with the recommendation on what to do with those preliminary reviews and investigations.
Okay. One more follow-up question. So would it help the commission if the law were changed so that you were able to prioritize the severity of these charges?
Chairs, Senator Whitsitt.
I mean the impartial commission.
I hope that's okay with the two chairs, me.
We're good.
Cutting that off. I'm
we're
sorry.
Good.
Senator Whitsitt.
I'm supposed to do it too, but it ties my tongue. So.
Usually he just says, hey, you.
So with all due respect, I respect you folks a great deal, but Chair Senator Whitsitt, I would say rarely do I have to pull resource off of one to another case. Now, having said that, there are cases that take up a lot of my resource, and I have my investigators come in my office wondering if they're going to be able to complete their duties before those statutory deadlines. So the statutory deadlines are always a consideration because sometimes cases just take a lot more work than others. So to answer your question, it could be helpful to look at, instead of looking at the deadlines, look at what we want to answer. But again, I don't run into it too often, but I do find on occasion that my investigators are in my office saying that they're overworked and wondering if they're going to be able to complete their work by the time that the meeting is due.
Thank you.
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you. And first of all, yeah, abbreviate however the heck you want. I've got a long name. I'm looking at this sheet here, and I don't know if you're going to get to it, but it actually details out the disposition analysis of the complaints that were filed. Are you planning on getting to that at some point further in your thing, or is that?
I think I've supplied that. Chair, I think I've supplied that as informational.
Okay.
If you have questions about that, it's an ongoing. It's actually part of we use for our performance measures.
I guess the reason I'm asking is because I'm thinking about Senator Witsit's very thoughtful questions, and you know that some complaints may be that they use the postage stamp that they shouldn't use. I'm exaggerating slightly, and some may be, you know, they misappropriated hundreds of thousands of dollars from city coffers, right? And so there is a wide range, and I also am not an attorney, so I don't understand what own motion, stipulated order, default order, and contested cases are, as opposed to. But this is, I guess I'm just trying to understand, like, if you get 112 complaints, some of them you're probably going to be able to dispose of pretty darn quickly, right, as being relatively not concerning, and some of them are going to take a lot more time.
Chair Senator Hayward, that is true. I think if you actually look at that sheet, in this last year we had quite a few complaints because, as you can imagine, the commission's had a bit of a bright light on it recently.
Yeah, probably.
And that we received a lot of complaints that just simply aren't inside of our jurisdiction. They're simply either bad management by government. You know, I didn't let somebody speak, I fired somebody, things like that we don't get involved in. So in this last year, you can see there was an exorbitant amount that we call non-jurisdictional, that those are the ones that come to my desk, I look at them, I don't have a reasonable belief there's been an ethics, a violation inside of the laws that we regulate, and so I do not open them. So those literally are just my time.
Got it. So, yeah, so in 2013, you had 120 total complaints, but 38 of those were non-jurisdictional, versus in 2014, you had 112, but 75 of them were non-jurisdictional.
Correct.
Leaving you only with 37 that were actually within your jurisdiction, if I'm doing my arithmetic correctly.
That is correct.
Got it. Thank you very much.
And I think this next slide kind of gives an overview of that sheet you were looking at. As you can see, over the last 5 years, about 41% of our complaints are around ethics, 45% are executive session, and 14% are in lobby. Now, what I'll say about executive session is the complaints on executive session are on the governing body. So that means when we get that complaint in, even though maybe only one person in the governing body did something out, like, you know, the chair drug him into executive session for the wrong reason, everybody in the governing body that was at the meeting is included. So most of those complaints end up being between 5 and 7 members of the governing body. So those complaints can get rather large just with the number of people. Out of those same complaints, I've broken down what the cities, county, state, education, special districts, and others have. So you can kind of see the percent of complaints. And when we talk about the funding model that the commission has, this was one of the reasons for that funding model, because our resources are going statewide to all levels of government out there. Administration, I won't go into this too much, but again, I want to talk about the 1,700 jurisdictions. This is management, managing the staff. This is all the support functions of the agency. And, of course, this is representing the agency for legislation, the biennial budget, any media, or any other kind of special projects. And we'll talk about special projects that this agency has had over the last biennium. That's an IT project that's out there. Here's some cost containment measures that the commission has instilled. One is that we get a lot of paper in the agency. We get a lot of public records requests. We try to scan as much of that into PDF files. An example of that is all of your folks' SEIs. It seems like everybody wants to see those SEIs. So when they come in, we go ahead and scan them in, because we know we're going to get a lot of records requests for those. That way we're not copying them constantly. The other side of that coin, too, is we can provide that record to the requester at no cost, because we already have a PDF file of it, and it's simply just emailing them those PDF files. We purchased a digital recording device. It may not sound like a big deal to some larger agencies out there, but by eliminating the need for cassette tapes, now our meetings that we hold every 6 weeks are actually on our website. So if anybody would like to listen to the verbatim discussion that's happening inside the commission, the robust discussion that we have at all times, they're welcome to do that. Sometimes it's pretty entertaining to listen to. I talked a little bit about the webcam earlier. This webcam is and the software to produce the online kind of real-time webinars has been very helpful for us in getting training out to a lot of people at a very small cost. And again, we live in a building with seven other small agencies, so we share a lot of costs with them in office space, equipment, meeting rooms, data lines, things like that. So it helps us in keeping our costs down. The performance measures, you can see that the performance measures have not changed over the last biennium. I will tell you that this last customer service survey that we have put out, a lot of people are not happy with us, but they seem to be not happy with the issue that's been out there. And it's kind of funny, the first thing we asked them if they had any contact with us, they say no, but then they're not happy with us. So so I think we're going to have a little dip in customer service. We normally are very high on customer service with our folks, but I think we're going to see a small change in that.
Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Person, they were bringing us back to the bright light we were talking about. And we're being inundated by questions from constituents regarding what is the Ethics Commission doing. And our responses to them that to our knowledge, the Ethics Commission hasn't convened a meeting yet, hasn't been too well received. So the perception there is not good. And that was why I was asking earlier if it would help you to be able to prioritize certain issues that are of great public interest and move forward on them as opposed to putting them in the queue.
Chairs, Senator Whitsitt, again, I would go back to the answer that I given you before is I think that there are some issues that come about that would be very helpful on. And I understand people's frustrations with that the commission is going to meet at this time and that's when it's going to be decided because they want a decision today. However, sometimes you also have to give me time to kind of look at the information to be able to give an accurate report to my commission so that they can make a decision going forward. And so in the absence of getting a lot of extra resource into the agency to be able to get through all of that work, and I'll give you an example, is in this last one that we're talking about that is bright light, I was provided one of these little sticks that I stuck in here that has over 30,000 emails on it. And so, for this staff that I, it's hard for us to go through all of that in this time frame. So sometimes speeding up the meeting isn't always necessarily the answer because I may not have a good answer for my commission by just moving the meeting forward. But I understand your frustration in this I will tell you that we are also frustrated by it. And like I say, and again, this issue too, you might have seen that new information was coming in during the time that the commission was trying to wrangle with what we already had. And so it seemed to me a moving target that was difficult for us to grab. So I hope I answered your question, sir.
Well, just to some extent, it seems that and I'm not saying this particular interest, but you may start with something that is appears to be a civil matter and a little bit of investigation shows that it may be a criminal matter, then I would think that it should be expedited. I mean, that's just my own personal opinion, that if it's if it is likely to show up into a criminal charge, then we ought to be drop things and start looking at that one.
But. Chairs, Senator Whitsitt, I don't disagree with you. I will tell you that the majority of the time, it's usually the other way around. There's been a criminal matter, and the criminal authorities actually tell us about it. So a public official has, taken some monies or resource away from a public entity, have been convicted of that, and then we're supplied with the information. So this it's unusual for ours to kind of meld into that criminal investigation, but I agree with you on that. So,
thank you. Let's continue.
I'm sorry. some of the major budget drivers. Again, we talked about the law changes that happened in 7 and 9. Online reporting and posting of the agency's information on the web will begin in 16. So I just probably should have had that highlighted and had some kind of like sound that said da-dum or, you know, but it's a big deal for us. This is the online reporting system for not only SEIs, the statements of economic interest, but also the lobbyists and the entities that hire lobbyists. Their reporting on a quarterly basis will be online, on the web in 2016.
Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, Representative.
Thank you. Having been here in 07 and 09, we had a lot of controversy about the legislation that was passed. And if you're going to get to this later, that's fine. Has it increased your cost appreciably? I know lobbyists that are still disgruntled about that they can't spend more money on different things than events and stuff that they used to prior to this legislation. So just whatever. Yeah, I'd be curious how this really impacted you, as because it did definitely impact us as legislators.
Chairs, Representative Comp, I would say that the biggest impact to the agency was providing all of the advice to folks, asking questions, because they had done it one way before the law changes, and there was a new way. Now, as far as the disgruntlement of it, I think at first there were some growing pains that went along with it. But I would say now that I think people are pretty used to operating inside the system, and that, in fact, this agency has a bill in right now trying to add relatives to one of the exceptions that allows you folks to go out to organizations, because they invite you out to organizations at night to either speak with them or participate with them, or sometimes they're even honoring you. And relatives was left out of that thing. So members of household was in, but if you have, let's say, like a college-age child that doesn't live in the home anymore and you want them to come out and see you get an award, they weren't allowed to go along with you. So so we keep kind of looking at the laws and making some subtle changes, but overall I think people have kind of come to learn to live within the new framework. And as far as, like, say, the cost of the agency is, again, the hundreds of informal advice that we give, where people call or email us asking if they can attend certain things or go certain places or accept different gifts that are out there. And that's not just with you folks, but it's with all public officials throughout the state.
Follow up, Mr. Please. Chair. I am exceptionally appreciative of the change that from, and I don't remember the years, but where we had to include all of our family members or list all that. I have 13 brothers and sisters, and it took quite a while for me to keep up a list of all my family just to put on the EIS form. So I really appreciate that was modified.
Chairs, Representative Cup, I don't think you're alone in that appreciation that was out there. I know as an agency, we were appreciative of that change, too.
Can you remind me, the Statement of Economic Interest, is that statutorily created, or is that created through you folks?
Chair Smith, that is a statute. It's
the components that are in it.
The components that are in it are in statute, okay. And the officials that file the SEI are also in statute.
Interesting. Okay, thank you.
Yes. So, again, in this budget, we have a couple policy packages. Both of them are around the electronic reporting system, essentially finishing up the work on that system. Again, the agency is going to continue to focus its efforts in training public officials, lobbyists, and entities to hire lobbyists. And now coming down here, the required reports will no longer be on paper, and people say, well, that's going to save us money. And there's going to be some savings with the agency as far as postage and mailings and things like this. But that money inside the agency now is going to be used for looking at the reports and making sure that those reports are accurate and trying to get some audit function around those reports. The real savings here from the electronic reporting system is going to be to businesses in the state of Oregon. They're no longer going to have to mail us reports. They're no longer going to have to wonder if the reports are filed. I think Chair Montoya can vouch for me that just about each meeting we have some folks before us that believe that their reports were filed and they were not, or that they registered clients that they had not, and now they can simply look up online instead of asking their staff if they've got those in. They can look up online and see that the agency has them and can view those online. So I think a lot of savings is going to happen, and if there were lobbyists in the room, I think they would come up and testify that they're looking forward to 2016. And in fact, in December of this year, we'll be having them register their clients online. So it's a little bit before 2016.
Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm always interested to see automated systems be either established or improved. I'm kind of curious about how this one is going to be developed. The first is on this issue of, I wonder if it got filed. You don't know if your paper thing was received. I've actually taken the time to call and say, did you get it, or did you get the fax? Because I've been so worried I would be out of compliance because I didn't know. However, will an automated system automatically generate an email message saying the form's been received?
Chair, Representative Nathanson, yes, it will. And so you will get notification that it has been filed. And just a step more of you calling us, we've actually, a lot of people actually sent those certified mail. They'll no longer need to have that additional expense to make sure they get a card back in the mail that we received it.
And an additional follow-up. Sometimes there's information that's repeated year after year after year. If your address hasn't changed and your major sources of income are the same. I'm speaking now the kind of form that I would fill out and my colleagues would, and thousands of elected and appointed officials around the state. For all that stuff that we repeat all the time, will the new system allow forms to be pre-populated with data and then you only need to change what's different? That's pretty common in all sorts of other things that we use in business applications.
Chair, Representative Nathanson, at this time it does not do that. There has been quite a bit of talk about that, and it may be an upgrade that we talk about with the system, but at this time, what we're going to do is we're going to send you out a report, and it's going to be online, and you're gonna fill that out. Now you will have access to your prior report, and you can take the information off that report and basically plug it in, but it won't pre-populate your information.
Yeah, I guess speaking as a licensee, somebody who's a licensee of a different state board, which does do that, I would strongly encourage you guys, because Representative Nathanson's right. I mean, most of us who fill these forms out. I used to fill when I used to be a registered lobbyist a long time ago, and my information didn't change, and certainly I'm not planning on moving out of my house anytime soon. So,
and it's not groundbreaking technology. It's in use in other places.
So anyway, we just encourage you to consider that.
So really quick, Madam Co-Chair, I have to leave to another commitment. I've passed the gavel over to my co-chair. Perfect. Appreciate all the work you're doing, and I'm going to ask you to continue to work closely with Mr. Borden, who we rely on.
All right.
So, can I just clarify, Representative Nathanson, are you going to have to?
I have to leave soon. Someone's going to come get me when a bill is being heard.
And do we know if Representative Hurd is coming?
He's ill. Excused.
Okay, so we'll just switch back from a public hearing to an informational hearing if we lose quorum again. So, okay.
Well, and I'll cook along here.
Perfect. Thank you. I'll get it going.
So, move forward here. Again, the electronic reporting system. I say reporting system, it's filing system. I'm sorry, I keep using terms interchangeable. So the agency actually hired a development vendor, and we contracted for professional project management services. We just simply don't have those resources inside the agency. The development, there's five different modules. The development is 30% complete at this time. We've had user acceptance testing that happened in August we'll begin in August of 2015. There will be a pilot project. We're going to have a few lobbyists and a few clients actually go in and do a pilot project in October of this year. And then in December, we're going to have all lobbyists start to register their clients. The system will officially launch on January 1st, and the project is on time, within the scope, and under budget. And I will talk about this vendor just really quick. NICUSA is the vendor that is building this system, and they have agreed to build this system at no cost to us, and basically we pay a subscription fee each year for that system. So the agency was able to avoid those development costs, and basically we'll pay a subscription fee in the next biennium. That's part of our policy packages. And so this first policy package that we're talking about is essentially to complete the work. Unfortunately, not all projects kind of end inside the biennium. So it's to complete the work. You can see the numbers down there for project management, to perform change management, and to train all the users of the system, including the public, so they can go out and view the reports that are filed on there. Funding. So this funding is needed basically to complete the project and be online or on time. You'll see the number of other funds that are there. Policy package number two is to pay that subscription fee. We'll pay $63,500 per year for the system. So it'll be $127,000 for the 15-17 biennium. And I wanted to spend just a few minutes on this continuum here. What I wanted to show you folks was, and I think Senator Whitsitt had talked a little bit about this, is that as things get more complex in the agency, the costs start to rise up significantly. So to give you an example here, for information calls or calls for advice, emails for advice, it's a very low cost to us. They call us, we provide email advice to them, and they have an answer pretty quick. As you see, when they start asking for more written advice, like some written informal advice that's underneath my signature, now that takes a letter, takes more time, takes me to write that letter. It goes up to staff opinions and then to formal advisory opinions that are actually voted on by the commission, up to and including attorney general opinions. So as you look at this continuum, just kind of think of, as we ask for, as things go down this line, the cost increase significantly. And when we talk about complaints, you know, at the beginning of a complaint, if it doesn't get open, the cost is very minimal. But once it starts getting open and we start working that, as time goes on, the cost increase.
Can I just clarify one thing there?
Sure.
If all goes well, I'm thinking about policy package 102 here. If all goes well, these costs should essentially be ongoing for the subscription costs, right?
That's correct, yes.
So what's the plan for future biennia in terms of incorporating this into your assessment system? Because really it's the users who should be paying for this. We don't pay individual fees when we file our SEIs or when the lobbyists file their things, right?
Yes, all of these policy packages are inside of our assessment, and so they will continue to be part of the assessment by state and local governments.
I guess maybe I'm not asking my question clearly.
I'm sorry.
No, you shouldn't apologize. I'm the one who didn't ask the question well. I understand why this year is a policy option package. I guess what I'm asking you is, when we're visiting with you at this time 2 years from now, will this just be incorporated into your assessment process as part of your regular ongoing agency budget and not be a separate policy option package, or will it be a separate policy option package again?
Chair, my understanding is it will be in our normal assessment. It will not be a policy package, but I think Mr. Board can
answer that. Because in essence,
the plan is not to.
Yeah, before Mr. Borden answers, and he's probably going to give me a better answer. But in essence, this isn't the policy option package 102 isn't really optional, right? POPs are supposed to be optional, right? We get to have some discretion over those in theory. And this isn't really optional. We already authorized you guys to do this. In theory, the only optional one is 101, whether we want you to finish the job. But once it's there, we have to pay for it, or what's the point of having invested the money? And this was something we wanted, and it sounds like it's going smoothly. So I guess I'm a little puzzled why this didn't get incorporated in to the assessment for this biennium, unless I'm missing something.
Chair Senator Hayward, I think that the CFO's office and LFO's office are probably better equipped to answer the reason why it's set up the way it is in this biennium.
Thank you, Mr. Burson. I'll let you off the hook. Do you want to ask something, Mr. Borden, or should we wait for CFO to talk? Mr. Miller, do you want to chime
in? Chair Steiner Hayward, members of the committee, kind of the theory is...
Can you just introduce yourself? You haven't already. Sorry. Thanks.
Sorry. For the record, my name is Travis Miller with the Chief Financial Office. And in terms of why this is, you know, optional in the current biennium, is kind of building off the kind of theoretical idea of current service level, because it's an increase in the service level being offered. So going forward, it would be incorporated, so it would be permanent.
Okay. Well, this is not your fault because this is how we structure it, but in essence, we're also saying that we're also in theory taking away some of the costs that come from processing all these things, right? Because ultimately, there should be, or at the very least, we're repurposing people who would have had to do this into doing things that are more functional. It's kind of like what we're doing with the Department of Revenue with their core system upgrade, right? We're not saving them money per se. We're just shifting what they can do with the money that they have, right?
I believe that's a fair picture of what we're trying to do here, yes.
Okay. Thanks. Senator, what's it?
Yeah, just on a different. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Person, do you have the statutory authority to contract out investigations?
Chair, Senator, what's it? It is not in the statutes to be able to do that. So, no, I do not have a specific statutory authority to do that.
Would that help you?
I've never considered that. I think any help is helpful. So, but I've never thought of that. I appreciate you bringing it up.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions for Mr. Burson before Mr. Miller does his part of this? Mr. Miller, the floor is yours.
Again, my name is Travis Miller with the Chief Financial Office. I'm here to present the Governor's budget for the Ethics Commission. In terms of the policy and funding issues, we've adequately addressed those for the most part. The electronic filing system implementation, this is a major project. And also, there was pretty ample discussion of the violations of the executive sessions of public meetings law. There's a bill related to that, kind of expanding rulemaking authority. So hopefully we can kind of bring that under control. And it also kind of fits in with the refocusing of the mission, becoming more proactive, essentially offering the training so that we can hopefully violate these. I actually had the pleasure of attending one of these sessions, very informative, Columbia River Gorge Commission. So just kind of informing the commissions to keep themselves out of trouble. And it can be very minor stuff. In terms of the Oregon's 10-year plan, this ties in with the improving government, basically ensuring that state government is trustworthy by enforcing these laws. And I would say beyond enforcement, really educating public officials. In terms of the budget, there is a 15% increase from the 2013-15 LAB, but that's reflecting the addition of the policy option packages, 200,000 of that being for development. So a moderate increase, but in terms of staffing and what they're actually doing in terms of their operations, no significant change. And as discussed before, the electronic filing system, that's about $200,000 for continued implementation. And finally, the subscription fee with NICU USA. And really, I think this arrangement worked out really well for the Ethics Commission, and essentially we were able to transfer the risk onto the vendor. Essentially, if it doesn't work, we don't have a subscription fee. We still have a statutory deadline, but I think it worked out well.
And just to be clear, one other thing, that $127,000 represents only three quarters of the biennium, right? Because you won't be up and running with this until January of 2016, or do we start paying that cost at the beginning of the biennium, even though the project isn't completed yet?
The subscription fee will begin to be, I'm sorry, Chair Steinhardt. The subscription fee will begin to be paid at the time that the system is launched.
Okay.
And so we plan on, during this next biennium, there will be two payments made of $63,500 in each one of those years. So each biennium will have two payments. But you're right, there's going to be some meld over into the next one. But the agency is going to actually expend the funds in 15-17. So we pay ahead. We pay for today, for the next year. We don't pay at the end of the year going
back. No, I understand. I guess the question is, if you're not going live with the whole thing until January 1st of 2016, then in theory you wouldn't start paying on it until, I see what you're saying. So you're going to pay a year's worth in January of 2016 or December or whatever for the 2016 year calendar year, and then you'll pay a year's worth at the beginning of 2017 for the 2017 calendar year, even though that's extending into the next biennium.
Yes, Chair, and actually the time frame right now to actually launch it through that pilot project is October. So once they deliver a working system to us, if we have a working system in October that works, that we'll start paying at that point.
Okay. Sounds good. Senator Johnson.
I think you just answered my question. I mean, I couldn't help but smile when you said we wouldn't pay licensing fees for a system that doesn't work. Well, no kidding. So I was just trying to figure out how this whole thing worked, and I think that last exchange just covered it.
Great. Thank you. Any other questions?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, please, Senator.
Have you had any contracts that have been reviewed for legal sufficiency on this information technology? I'm thinking back our old favorite Cover Oregon, Time and Materials. I mean, an incredibly bad contract. How is this contractually memorialized?
Chair Senator Johnson, even though this project was originally below $1 million and it didn't require as much oversight, we have actually conducted as much oversight as any project in here. So yes, it was reviewed by DOJ for legal sufficiency. We have DAS CIO's office involved in this. DAS ETS actually runs the vendor that we use is on a master service contract with the state of Oregon. And so DAS ETS actually oversees that master service contract. And we as agencies are actually able to add our projects to that. So we have had extensive oversight. And as you might remember, we have been before this group throughout the process in the quarterly e-board meetings, updating the group on the progress of the project.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to add something quickly. From the work that I've been doing for the past year, I believe that a review for legal sufficiency is not sufficient to protect the interests of Oregon. The words can be legal in the contract, but still the contract may not be as strong or appropriate as it could have been. And we're working on that through other proposed legislation.
Great.
That's very comforting. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, any other questions? Senator Whitsitt.
This is for Mr. Borden. This budget appears to use about half of the beginning balance. Could you give us a projection for the next biennium, not for 15-17, but
17-19? Yes. Happy to, Co-Chair and Senator, happy to provide that. Look, we should see that these one-time costs that the agency has experienced for last biennium and this biennium will go away, and it will reach more of, go back to a normal operating budget again with those assessment funds reflecting the ongoing licensing fee. But one question, if I may, of the agency is if those licensing fees are have any indexed factor to them, or will they always be $63,000 into the future?
My understanding is that it is $63,500 into the future. The only time that we've talked about any changes is that in any upgrades that come about that could end up taking more development time or expand into the subscription. I'll give you an example. There's discussion right now about looking at some type of case management system for the agency. Right now, all the complaints are still manual, and so they're full of papers. And as you can imagine right now, with the currently we have a request from a U.S. attorney to supply records from a file, and since I am not willing as the director of the agency to allow that file to go all over the place, my investigator is going to scan those records because the chain of custody of that file, I can't allow it to go every place around. So case management system may be looked at in the future. So if something's added, then the subscription fee could increase, but there's no plans from NICU USA to increase the subscription fee.
Thank you. Senator Johnson.
Mr. Burson, you just said something that I think is really important, and it is causing me to think about other contextual issues. I am making the assumption, perhaps erroneously, that you are perhaps responding to requests for subpoena. I mean, you're responding to subpoenas and requests for information. I don't know, and this is probably a question to Mr. Borden, whether or not all agencies that were subject to subpoenas are keeping track of their time in a separate way. Because I talked to another agency head this morning who has five people doing nothing but record retrieval, copying, manipulation of data, and I don't use that in a bad way, I just mean handling data, to respond to a flurry of federal subpoenas. And I think that it is important to keep track of those costs in some way. It's not unlike some of the huge licensing or permitting issues that come to state agencies where they spend years reviewing requests for permits, and all of the financial burden is borne by the state. And I just think we ought to monetize some of the time that's being spent.
I think that's a really interesting point, Senator.
I don't need you to respond now. This is a more global issue, but your comment about having people retrieving data just caused me to think about it.
Chair, Senator Johnson, there is the plan in my agency is that our time is tracked on this specific project.
Thank you.
Thanks. Do we have any public testimony, Ms. Jensen? No. Okay. Do we have any other questions for these gentlemen? All right, I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 5022. Is there any other business before the committee today? If not, we'd like to thank you all for your concise and informative testimony, and we're adjourned. See you all on Monday. Testimony, and we're adjourned. See you all on Monday. Informative